You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
So, Alan, thanks for sitting through that bit of a shambles of an intro there.
Not at all.
How are you going? What's happening in science this week?
Well, I've got the lurgy, so that's what's happening
in
my science. I know, yeah, everyone moves away.
Yeah, I'll just sit on this side nice and comfortably.
It does rather suck. But what is happening in science this week? Big things happening in science this week. The first of which, there's a big study at the University of California in Irvine, and this is a 15-year study where they surveyed 1,700 nonagenarians.
Nonagenarians?
A nonagenarian. What's a nonagenarian?
I have no idea.
Am I a nonagenarian?
No, you are very far away from being a nonagenarian.
Do I want to be a nonagenarian?
You probably do want to be a nonagenarian eventually, yeah.
It makes me think someone who's not going to age a hell of a lot more. Is that pretty rude of me?
You're sort of there. A 90-year-old.
A 90-year-old, okay.
Yeah, okay. So
yeah,
someone in their 90s, okay? So they've surveyed 1,700 nonagenarians over a period of 15 years, and they have come to the conclusion that moderate drinking could help lengthen life. There we go. I know. I'm happy about
time.
This.
About time.
Only moderate, though. None of this binge stuff.
This is where science has come to. This is the pinnacle of science, 2018.
Yeah, pretty much. They should give up now, really.
Absolutely. They've answered everything. So what are they saying? They're saying it's time to give up the gym membership and sign up for Happy Hour?
Well, interestingly enough, they did sort of a comparison between these different sort of factors that could or could not prolong life. So what they found was that one or two wines or beers a day decreased your chance of premature death by 18%. Okay.
So my first question to that is, what is premature death? Because I think walking in front of a car.
And exactly that was my point as well. I mean, you know, dying before your time, I guess, supposedly. But yeah. I mean, once you're a nonagenarian, you'd think, well, you've pretty much, you know,
pretty
you've
satisfied
pretty much got
by
there,
that
haven't
point.
You? But I guess these are the long-lived people. So, you know, what have they been doing throughout their lives that enable them to live for such a long time? So apparently the drinking of wine or a couple of beers a day is all good. 18% less chance of premature death. They also looked at exercise. So those who did 15 to 45 minutes of exercise daily, they got an 11% less chance of premature death. So there you go. It's a whole 7%.
It's a big shame to all my friends that go to the gym when you can find me down at the pub.
It's not cumulative. Like, it's not on top of, you know, gym on top, exercise on
top.
So if
we did the gym and the drinking.
This is a comparison between the two things, seemingly.
Yes.
So, you know, that's a whopping 7%. So as you say, you sit in the pub and, you know, have those beers daily and everything, and things are going to be good for you to make 90, basically.
To me, it seems like stress has got to play a big part of that, because I know I'm certainly less stressed at the pub than I am at the gym. Probably about 7% less stressed, if I'm honest.
No, fair enough.
And they just 2 beers.
Well, they also look, well, actually, drinking is not the best thing for you, unfortunately, nor is exercise. Apparently, the best
thing
for
you. Should
we
cut that study there then? Is that?
No.
No,
the best thing for you, apparently, is to have a hobby that you do 2 hours a day. And if you've got some hobby that you do 2 hours a day, then you're 21% less chance of dying prematurely.
Are they talking about an intellectually stimulating hobby?
I believe so, that sort of thing. Okay. So something like drinking doesn't count unfortunately.
Yeah. 2 hour happy hour hobby a day doesn't quite cut the mustard.
But is it just like, because doing something that you like kind of provides you with happiness?
Seemingly, yeah. Yeah, that seems to be the answer. Now, the whole thing with this is, look, next week somebody's going to come out and say that drinking 2 beers or 2 wines a day decreases your chances of living till, you know, that, this is the way that, sadly, sort of health research works because everybody's different. So health research really is a science of probability.
Also, obviously, you choose to look at the specific things, but you also leave behind a lot of other factors.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm assuming by the time you become a non...
A generian,
thank you. There's been a lot of reasons why you've lived to that age, and quite potentially you were just lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time a lot of the time,
or
lucky enough to not be in the wrong place.
Yes, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. So I don't know how they sort of get rid of all of those possible variables that there are, because there's an enormous number of variables. You know, people live totally different ways, and you can't do the experiment where you've got the same people, you know, taking one thing out of their diet or something like this. You just can't do it. So it then becomes, as I say, a study of probabilities, a study of statistics. And as that great man Rutherford once said, if your experiment relies on statistics, then you've got to design a better experiment.
So I read that the person presenting the study, Claudia Kouas, has said that she actually has no idea why it is that way, but it's very clear it is that way. So the message I'm getting is it's fine to have a couple of drinks and maybe think about it not too much.
I don't see why not.
I'll take that one from there. Okay. Let's move on. Who is Stanley Miller and why are we thinking about him today?
Well, today he would have been 88 years old. And actually, this segues quite nicely from that previous story. The nonagenarian, so he would have been 88, so he would have been nearly
so
there.
But pushing on that.
He probably didn't drink enough, maybe.
He could have been for the study in a couple of years.
Yeah, only one beer a day.
Yes.
Yeah, that's his fault.
Anyway, so how did life begin? That's you know, if you can answer that question, you've probably got yourself a Nobel Prize.
We probably won't need you on the show anymore.
Yes.
He won't want to come.
Yeah.
So that's a big question that has obviously been answered or asked since the dawn of time. You know, now, the basis of life are the molecules that we're made up of. So we're made up of a myriad of molecules, obviously our DNA that imparts our genetic information. We're also made up of things called amino acids, which make up all our proteins, which do all the work in our bodies and stuff like that, et cetera, et cetera. And so the whole thing about the universe is, you know, there was the Big Bang and then the planet started condensing and then they got an atmosphere, et cetera, et cetera. Now, these proteins and these amino acids and these DNA molecules, now, they're complicated molecules. They're generally sort of large, except for the amino acids. They're small, but they go on to make proteins which are large. How did they come about in this sort of prehistoric atmosphere of the planet where there was very, very few compounds available to make these things, okay? So he sort of thought about this in about 1952. He was a graduate student then, PhD student, aged about something ridiculous like 22 or something like that.
He was setting the bar pretty high there for us graduate students.
And so he went to a supervisor and said, look, I think I'm going to do this experiment where I can figure out whether all of those sort of simple molecules that were present on the Earth, whether we could turn them somehow into amino acids or proteins or DNA or whatever, okay? So what he did was extremely simple. It's one of these experiments that's brilliant in hindsight, and you think, shit, why didn't I think of that? But he did. So what he did, basically, he just got a container, and in it he put steam, hydrogen, methane, and ammonia. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they are simple molecules. Water, hydrogen molecules, methane, which would have been present on the prehistoric Earth, that's just CH4.
So our building blocks we're talking about.
Yeah, building blocks, yeah, and ammonia. Now, normally you just mix them together, and they'll just sit there and look at you. They won't do a damn thing. So what he did was he passed an electrical discharge through them for a week, okay, through this mixture of molecules. Now, why the electrical discharge? Well, the Earth, the primordial Earth, I guess, had lightning, okay? There's a decent electrical discharge for you.
So he's trying to recreate the situation.
Exactly. So he's trying to recreate the situation that existed on primordial Earth. So he passed this through, passed the electrical discharge through these mixtures for a week, and then at the end of that, he analysed what was present. And what he found amazingly was the presence of some amino acids. And amino acids are the building blocks of life.
Now, is this where I was doing some very unreliable research on his Wikipedia? There was a concern that this might have been fly feces in the test tube, but they chose to pass on this. But I believe initially there was the concern that this may have been fly droppings. But they decided to pursue with the study anyway.
You Wikipedia people, my goodness me. Yeah.
No at all, there we go.
I'm sure it's, you know, well-referenced and everything.
Yeah, I'm sure someone was standing there at the time noting it down.
Well, they did the experiment, they got these results and they published them, and, you know, this was a big deal. He then repeated the experiment about 20 years later using some more sophisticated techniques to do the analysis. In the original experiment, he found about 4 amino acids. Now, there's around about 20 or 22 naturally occurring amino acids that go into all our proteins and stuff, depending on which book you read. And so he repeated the experiment 20 or so years later, and he did find 10 amino acids then and a whole bunch of other ones that are not natural. And then after his death, his original samples from 1952 were unearthed. And so they went and analysed those, again, using the really, really state-of-the-art modern techniques. And again, they found 22 amino acids in amongst all of those. So when he did the analysis, he only found 4.
Was that just a limitation of the technology?
Yes, it was. Yeah. So, you know, it was primitive in those days compared to what we can do now.
So he, at the time, wasn't even necessarily aware of the nature of his discovery? Or to the extent of it?
No, not the extent. It was basically proving that you could make amino acids, the building blocks of life, from those simple ingredients that would have been present on the primordial Earth. And so It's called the Miller-Urey experiment. Urey was his PhD supervisor who had already won the Nobel Prize for some of his work in chemistry. But seemingly it was Miller's idea, you know, this whole experiment. So he's sort of called the father of prebiotics. And I think, you know, a really, really cool experiment. Simple, but...
How relevant is his work to modern-day scientific experience looking at prebiotic work or looking at the formation of amino acids? Are we still relying on that information that was discovered there?
Well, I think we're basically saying that this was a possible way by which life could have started on Earth. Okay, it's a theory, but, you know, it's a very, very
but it's a pretty
compelling
good one.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's... You know, it's still recognised today as being the start of all this sort of work. And to my knowledge, again, you know, this is sort of held up as being the best theory that we've got at the moment of how life could have started.
Well, moving from a historical theory like we're looking at here to something that's pretty modern, something happening today, we've got a new exotic state of matter. Can you tell us what that is and why I'm imagining something in a Hawaiian shirt with a cocktail?
I have no idea about the latter, goodness. So, as you know, we've got matter, we've got solids, liquids and gases. So those are the only sort of three states of matter. But actually, there are a few more states of matter.
Like in between?
Sort of in between-ish. Like a plasma, yes, absolutely. So the sort of the centre of the sun is a plasma where you sort of strip all the electrons off atoms. So you sort of get bare nuclei plus sort of the electrons floating around. So that's a state of matter, but it only occurs under very, very forcing conditions. There's another state of matter called a Bose-Einstein condensate, which was discovered about 20-odd years ago now, which only exists under very forcing conditions. In other words, really, 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 really cold. And if you go to a few billionths of a degree above absolute zero, you can get these atoms that basically behave as one thing. So a group of atoms that behaves as a single atom, sort of thing.
From my very limited chemistry knowledge, is that... when they're behaving in a certain way because they have such a lack of energy compared to if they're at a normal temperature?
That's my understanding of it, that they've just got so little energy that they just sort of tend to clump together and do the same thing. Now, that's probably a very, very facile description of it.
But it works for today.
It does. So what these guys have done is they've taken a Bose-Einstein condensate, so a bunch of atoms, and they happen to be strontian atoms. And what they have done is they've hit one of these atoms with a laser, okay? Now, you know all about atoms, don't you? Because they taught you all about Rutherford at school and his model of the atom.
He's on the $100
bill. He is on the $100
bill. Which I haven't seen one of in a very long time, so he's not that relevant to me.
So Rutherford said that the atom is made up of this tiny little nucleus, positively charged, and around this nucleus are a whole bunch of electrons, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the electrons take up most of the space in...
We're supposed to think of like an electron cloud, right?
You are, absolutely, yes. Yep. So what they did was to very, very carefully take one of these atoms and blat it with a laser, and what that does is to take the outermost electron and take it even further
away. Gives it a
away.
Bit of energy.
Yep. Look at you. I'm teaching this in first year at the moment. You could be in my class.
You're looking for a teaching assistant, a paid position? Hit me up.
I'll definitely be in the classroom.
Give me a couple of those Rutherfords.
So anyway... the electron goes further out now from the nucleus, and that sort of creates a whole lot of empty space in the atom. And what they did, remarkably, is stick 170 atoms, other atoms of strontium, into that empty space.
And we're talking entire atoms, not talking the nuclei.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very bizarre. So they call these Rydberg atoms, okay, after this guy Rydberg who did a lot of studies in what happens when electrons get further away from the nucleus and blah, 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 blah. And so what then happens, once you make this Rydberg atom, then it starts very, very weakly bonding to other normal atoms, and it forms this thing called a Rydberg polaron, which is now an
Rydberg
entirely...
Rydberg polaron.
There we go, Rydberg polaron. So,
wow.
You know, you can drop that in conversation while you're having your two beers tonight.
I just hope that someone else has the information to put behind it, otherwise it's going to be a real halt in the conversation.
So that seemingly is a new state of matter. Quite remarkable, the things that they do, and I think I'll be telling my first year class all about this afternoon.
For laymen like myself, I'm imagining it's like, you know, the size of these atoms we're talking about is so microscopic, it's unimaginable, and I'm imagining it's like trying to overload T-shirts into a drawer that's already full, except... This is just to give me a bit of a visual imagination.
Like
except when we're actually talking about the relative size, the radius from the nucleus to the electrons,
yes,
the space is actually huge, right? I mean, I've had it described as one person standing in the middle of Eden Park,
yes,
and then the electrons floating around the very outside of the block.
You put a P in the middle of Eden Park. They're almost right.
Almost.
P in the middle of Eden Park, and then the electron. Yeah, so the radius of the atom is essentially the
whole.
So
actually,
whole
in terms
Eden
of available
Park,
space, there is plenty of room.
There's a buttload. Absolutely.
Enough for 170 strontium atoms.
Enough for 170 strontium atoms. Here's my story I always tell my first-year students. If you've got a 10-cent piece, okay, and you're counting all of the atoms in a 10-cent piece at one atom per second. One, two, three. How long is it going to take you to count all the atoms in a 10-cent piece?
More than the 10-cent piece is worth.
Yes.
I don't know.
You've got to have a guess. You can't say...
Rest of the year?
The rest of the year? How long do you reckon?
Honestly, I have
No. We've got right, okay, to
you
got to
guess. You've got to guess something too big, okay, and then it will just sort of ruin
your
answer.
I'm going to go bigger than Connor, though.
Okay, you're going to go bigger?
Slightly bigger. Maybe okay. Like a couple of years.
A couple of years. Okay. 85,000 times the age of the universe.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Well,
it's not a
Jerry,
for sure.
So I still win, but...
Yeah, I'll give it to him.
So that's how small atoms are. They are okay. Tiny. So,
I suppose my final question is, with this new bit of information...
Yep.
What is the world of science going to look at doing with it?
Exactly. Well, you don't know, because this is what they call blue skies research, which, you know, people are very, very loath to fund because it's got no obvious outcome. But then neither did Einstein's sort of theory of relativity. It had no obvious outcome.
It's just an important question and an important answer that
exactly.
At some point...
It's all to do with nature, with everything.
With how the world is.
So yeah. It's just knowledge.
Yeah. It's just knowledge. Who knows? You might be able to apply it one day. We don't know. But, you know, it's an addition to humanity's store of knowledge.
Well, I think that's rather a poetic note to leave it on there.
Absolutely.
So, Alan Blackman, thank you very much for joining us for Dear Science. Always a listener favourite, I know, and a personal favourite of mine.
Thanks, Connor.
We're going to be shifting on. We've got a little bit of an air break, and we'll see you back on The Wire after this.
That was Dear Science.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.